Roberts?
Sir.
Your commanding officer gave you an order. He ordered you to fight. So you knocked his teeth out. Is that right?
Sir.
Is that all you've got to say?
Sir, it's all I want to say.
See that hill?
I noticed it as I came in.
We built it special. A few tons of sand and rock and a lot of labor and sweat. The prisoners built it.
Well, that's marvelous, sir. It's a great construction feat.
Something tells me you're going to get to know it well.
I don't want any special privileges.
It's hot on that hill. Hot.
I fancied I saw snow on the top when I came in.
Dead set on having a go at it, aren't you?
Oh, I can do without it, sir, but I think you've got other plans for me.
Hello and welcome, dear listener, to the Odd Job Pod. With myself, with Graham Sibley. Hello, Graham.
Hello, Gary.
And Terry DeFellin.
Hello, Terry. Gary Andrews.
Hello, hello. Welcome, everybody. Now, as you know, from this is a James Bond podcast. We talk a lot about James Bond. We also have our spin-off, The Action Movie Landfill, where, because we love action films, we kind of go deep into the 80s, 90s, early noughties. Now, it's been a bit of a dry spell for anything Bond. There's plenty still to talk about Bond, but let's just say things are moving slightly slowly in the new things to talk about Bond space. Now, there's lots of places we could go, but one place we thought would be really interesting is to take a look at the performances of the Bonds in other films while they were still Bond. I'm sure there is a much more catchy way of saying that, but by means of an explanation, there are plenty of films. Bond was not the only film that all these actors were doing whilst they were playing 007. Who can forget, for example, Cowboys versus Aliens, Daniel Craig's masterpiece during his time as Bond. And this is really interesting because you have a big, big persona. There is a very public idea of who this actor should be. So their choices outside of Bond are really fascinating. So we're going to dive around a little bit of the Bondography, if you will, and pick out some films across the next few Odd Job Pod episodes where they were part of the actor's filmography, but while they were playing Bond. So there's some lots of interesting things to unpick, and we've started off, and I thank Terry for this suggestion, with a film that I'll confess I had never seen, let alone heard of at all. It is a film from Sean Connery called The Hill, and doesn't sound like very much, but oh boy, there's a lot to get into there. So this was 1965. When Sean Connery's The Hill came out. And it is a prisoner of war drama, if you will. I won't go too much more into this in terms of explaining it, because you'll start to get the sense as we go through. But yes, there is a lot when you've got a Bond, at the time being Bond, in a prisoner of war drama. There is a lot to expect, and then there is a lot to unpick in terms of the film itself. If at this stage, like me, you've never seen The Hill, there are places. It's not easy to get at all. It's very hard to find. But go out and have a look, because you might actually want to pause, watch The Hill, and then come back. That's not a hill I will die on, but there is a hill that other people within this movie will die on. So let's get right on into it. And I'll just go straight to you, Terry. Why did you pick this movie, The Hill, 1965, with Sean Connery, discuss as part of the his period as Bond?
Graham and I had this idea of doing this strand in the pub, and I went away and did a small amount of research to sort of like find out which movies had been made, and that would qualify, and there I saw The Hill, and it is a film that I guess I must have just forgotten existed, but it's a film I've seen I think, a couple of times, a long time ago, probably back in the 1990s. I remember it being an extremely challenging and you know, probably quite harrowing film, but an extremely good film, an excellent film, and thought, well, gosh, why don't we start with that? Because that possibly sounds like a bit of a departure from what we're doing. And I think it's a really good example of what, you know, some Bond actors, well, certainly what Connery, I think, was trying to do when he was playing Bond, to try and alternate and play sort of like slightly different characters or in certainly different contexts. And he certainly, I think he kind of achieved that with The Hill. I don't know, maybe not. But yeah, a deeply emotional film for one reason or another, with an interesting production story as well. But I mean, shall I just very, very, very briefly set it up? It's set in a military prison in Libya, in North Africa, during the Second World War. And this is a prison not for prisoners of war. It's a prison for British soldiers who have broken the military code for a while, whether or not that be too much drink, too much fighting, desertion, assaulting an officer. It's basically a prison camp. And at the center of this camp is The Hill, which is a man-made hill. And it is essentially a punishment or a method of discipline, which is used on the prisoners. They climb that hill back down again for however long they can stand it. It's used as a form of correction. And it sort of becomes the focal point of an unfolding drama and a story of, I guess, probably what we could probably describe as abuse of power, and just the general human drama and examination of people at their absolute lowest possible ebb, both prisoners and prison guards. So an extraordinary dramatic rendition, beautifully shot, amazingly acted, and just an extraordinary piece of work.
Yeah, it is. It's a film that, having watched it for this podcast, I think will stay with me for quite a long time, because it is quite a powerful watch and very, very well acted. But let's kind of go into the Bond and Connery element of it. And Graham, more from a public perception, shall we say. So, you know, you're Connery, you're midway through your run as Bond. Obviously, he didn't necessarily know that. We know that Connery was starting to get a little bit, I'll do this. There, you start on latter Bonds of the Connery era. Maybe, yeah, I think it's unfair to say he is phoning it in, but you can definitely tell that his mind is going elsewhere. And he's got this offer of a prisoner of war drama. He takes it. Now, what do you think that most people who would have seen that Connery was attached to this film would have been expecting to see from Sean Connery in there? And what did they get instead?
It's not a Bond film, put it that way. I'm not sure if people would have been that surprised going into it with what they actually got. They know it's a prison drama. They know it's set in the Second World War. They also know it's black and white as well. And I'm not sure how that fits in the mid-60s, especially when you've got a marquee actor there coming in. There is a sense that this is more of an art house film. I mean, the cast in there is very recognisable, even at the time. There's lots of that in there. It didn't do very well at the box office, because I think it didn't really fly with what most people wanted to go and see at the time. And I don't think that's solely because it's black and white, because The Spy Who Came In From the Cold came out in the same year, probably did twice as, probably made twice the money that this did. But then again, it had the word spy in the title of it. So that was always going to help. Yeah, at the time, war films were going down and spy films were on their way up. So I don't know if people would have been that shocked to see what this film was like. It's very difficult to look back on it now because we've seen what Connery's canon was after he made this. So at the time, he hadn't made that many films at all. So that people could probably have gone there saying, well, all I know you as is James Bond. So, yeah, it's difficult to say. It's very difficult to look back on things and say, well, this is the movie-going public would have been disappointed with what they certainly shouldn't have been disappointed because this is a fantastic film. But, yes, it's very, very different to Goldfinger, which had been his previous Bond film. This comes out between Goldfinger and Thunderball.
Mm. And your perception, Terry, of seeing Connery in a war drama, you would, I think when I got the opening come in, when you first see Connery appear into the camp, again, I hadn't read up anything, so I knew no context whatsoever. And, you know, you've got a few smart answers back in the style of a potentially, you know, a few Bond quips. And, you know, part of me was like, oh, maybe here we go. This is going to be something where it's, you know, Connery playing Connery in a prisoner of war drama. Now, obviously, latter Connery, we know Connery can perfectly easily turn up and just play Sean Connery in a film. He kind of made a latter career out of playing Sean Connery. But as you come into this film, for me, the one thing that really surprised me, obviously, this is not a lighthearted film at all, but it plays on the perception of what you think you're going to get from a Sean Connery film. And what actually ends up is, I mean, I would probably say one of the best performances I think I've seen from Connery as an actor, outside of maybe The Man Who Would Be King, is the only other film that I can think about which really has Connery. Like, he's a good actor, but, you know, he can be Sean Connery. This is one where I've gone, wow, that was a performance. That wasn't just Connery turning up and being Connery as a big name in a film. This was Connery pushing himself as a dramatic actor.
Yeah, and indeed being pushed as well very hard by the director, Sidney Lumet, who imposed very, very strict conditions on filming during the production process. I don't think he's remembered kindly for the way in which he carried out the direction of that film. Certainly from what I've been reading about it. Connery lost a lot of weight during the course of that movie. Suggested, you know, in fairly unkind terms about how it had affected him while he was making it. I think in a lot of cases, I think what we were seeing from Connery was raw emotion as much as it was from acting. We really saw a very, very naked performance by him and absolutely stellar. I mean, from all of them, to be honest with you, it was absolutely amazing, incredibly emotional, you know, really authentic acting that I think, you know, really make that film at times also incredibly difficult to watch, while at the same time you couldn't really take your eyes off of it. I mean, more broadly with Connery, I mean, I think I have rather lazily in the past, I think I didn't really realise that Sean Connery could act, if I'm being honest with myself, until probably the later 80s, until The Untouchables, if I'm being completely honest with you. I think I kind of had a kind of lazy perception of Connery that he just played Bond. And that's all he could do. And then, you know, The Untouchables comes along and obviously he wins an Oscar for that performance. And you realize that this guy actually is a really good actor. And then he goes on and has an excellent sort of like stanza of his career where he goes on to do Red October and Name of the Rose and a stack of other movies for which he is rightly lauded. But this movie only goes to underline just how wrong I and probably anyone else might have been about Connery and his ability to act and to carry a movie of this weight. And if this significance. In that respect, it was a fantastic choice for him and an excellent, and it is a shame the movie is not as well remembered as it could be, frankly, because it's a quality piece of work. I mean, I think it did well at Cannes. It might have won an award at Cannes in 1965. It's just that I think probably it's such a downbeat film that maybe the 1965 audience just weren't really up for that kind of stuff.
Winner of best film in 1965 was Sound of Music, so I think that bears it out. There
you so that is indeed a very colourful film, Graham, isn't it? Unlike,
yes.
Yeah, I mean, there we are. I mean, the post-war European and American audiences were, you know, up for something a lot more upbeat, I think, and fun. They'd probably had enough of the grimness. I mean, the movie was, I mean, the War Office were absolutely livid when they saw early cuts of this movie. There was a paid consultant who was fired by Sidney Lumet because, in his opinion, he felt that the portrayal of the mistreatment of the inmates was, you know, bringing the British government into disrepute. The film wasn't without its controversy, but it's you know, as an artwork and in terms of its critical reception, yeah, it just seems to be completely out of it. Well, not out of its time. It's absolutely of its time because it's talking about class, it's talking about race, it's talking about, you know, sort of cruelty. It's talking about a lot of things that are relevant now, were relevant then. I just think that in 1965, nobody wanted to hear it.
No, it's a very, you know, the context of the 60s and you know, the types of films that were out there and the, yes, the kind of counterculture and everything that was going on culturally there. And 65 is obviously slap bang in the middle. I actually wonder, to a certain extent, it feels like it's a little bit of a film out of time by probably about 5 or 6 years. I think if this had been made in the very late 60s, early 70s, with the wave of cinema that started coming into there, I think it might well have been thought of and received quite differently, because it definitely sits into there. But one of the things I just wanted to pick up on as well, Graham, was that, you know, the point of this being right bang in the middle of the 1960s, you've got this, yeah, war drama. War dramas weren't really, you know, kind of, yeah, they'd kind of started coming out as we're getting away from the Second World War. They certainly weren't necessarily in vogue. And yet you've got this, the position of Connery is Bond, is he is an establishment figure. And yet in The Hill, he is this broken establishment figure who just becomes to the point of so anti-establishment in the end. There is the fantastic scene where there's between him and Harry Andrews, who plays the RSM in the account, where Connery's just basically like, I did my orders. I was a clockwork soldier like you, and pretty much I've got nothing. It's almost, you know, to a certain extent, I might be playing it up a bit, but it's that bit of, you know, what are you rebelling against? What have you got? And it feels like it sits actually as a very, to me, it felt like it was a very 1960s message, albeit one that probably would take a lot for somebody to sit there and unpack and then sit afterwards and go, oh, yeah, that was definitely a film that is very 60s in its approach to portrayal of authority and rebellion against authority. And I find it so fascinating that you've got a difference of Bond versus, yeah, Joe Roberts in this, who you know, ends up being the antithesis of everything that Bond would really stand for, as to rebel against the system.
I think if you make this film 5 years either side, it's entirely different. I'm not sure if you can make it. I don't know when the play came out, because there's obviously something about this that it feels like a play. I don't know if it was ever actually shown as a play, or whether it was just written as a play and then picked up as a screenplay. But I think this film is so 1965. It's sitting on the cusp of so many things. That scene at the end where Connery just absolutely shouts, tells Harry Andrews everything about what's wrong with the system, and the interchange that they have, it leads into this whole thing about the breakdown of the British Empire, the whole thing, 1965, it was like basically a new country was getting independence from the empire pretty much every month. This was the discourse at the time about how countries are gonna self-govern and things like that. So that's bang on time in that. That's the narrative of it. And that adds a whole different layer to the whole race question there. And the whole thing about getting Ozzie Davis in there to do it as well, which was just unbelievably good. I think if you put this in the 70s, there's a whole different set of stories that you're going to tell, and that's going to come across from the way that it's written and the way that the actors portray it as well. But as I said before, the fact that the choice is this is black and white is a choice, because at the time there's still a lot of films coming out in black and white and a lot of films in color. In fact, at the Oscars, the cinematography award is actually in two categories. You get there is a separate Oscar for black and white films and color films. It didn't win it. It won the cinematography BAFTA, but not. I don't think it even got nominated for an Oscar. I could be wrong there. But there are choices made within this film, and I think every choice that they make works, and it comes across just so well, and the stories it's not just one story. Actually, there's barely any story. Five guys go to prison, have a shit time. That's basically the story. But it obviously it's the emotional roller coaster that they all go through, and the way that it is portrayed. I don't think this is a difficult film to access. It tells stories we can all relate to, and I think when you look back at the time as well, the timing of the film is also very important, because this comes in about 3 or 4 years after National Service ended. So pretty much every adult that went to go and see this film probably did National Service. Every adult male, that is. Everyone in the cast served. Everyone in the cast, either in World War II or in National Service after the war, or enlisted like Connery did for a few years. So I think there's buy-in from all the actors in this, and I think which makes it even more interesting when you see the types of performances you get from it. And I think if you look at it in the context of timing, of being in the mid-60s, yeah, you are on the brink of counterculture really becoming mainstream, but not really in the UK. It's still got about 3 or 4 years. Remember that the Beatles are still wearing suits, I think, at this stage. Actually, no, they're not. It's all up between Hard Day's Night and Help, isn't it, at the moment? This is where we are, aren't we? So that gives you an idea of where British culture is. But interesting times. There is an accelerated push. And I think you see that in the types of Bond films that come out as well.
It's the time around it. And, you know, we've talked about this a lot about both in the action movie Landfill and Bond itself in terms of responding to threats. Now, this is less of a global threat, but there is, Terry, it's the film itself, and again, I'll just sort of, for those who haven't seen it, just give a little bit of a quick summary at this point of the five people go in, horrific abuse from prison guards, a lot of sort of power play within there, and there is death, and then a lot of people, a lot of great character acting, but a Bond goes to all around the world. This is possibly one of the most claustrophobic films I think I've ever watched. And talking about this as, you know, I always view Bond films, you know, when they're beautifully shot and done, like they are, you know, I think they're works of art. Not all of them are. Die Another Day. Let's forget not go into that place. Russia with Love being a great example of just a beautifully shot, well put together film. This is, you know, as a piece of art, The Hill is disturbing, I think you would call it, and claustrophobic, but it is just utterly gripping in a way that I I haven't seen a film like that for that's kind of left a mark on me after watching it quite a while. And I felt claustrophobic watching that film.
Yeah, it was Alex Cox, when he reviewed it for a Movie Drone back in the 90s, said it succeeded in making even a prison cell look interesting. And it's quite funny because the establishing shot of that, is it the establishing shot, the word I'm looking for? The opening shot for the titles.
Yeah.
Are actually really, because it starts off, so we're under no illusions what kind of movie we're going to watch, because it's portraying a man being punished on the hill who collapses and has to be picked up. But then there's this huge, long tracking shot that actually opens up so that we can sort of see the desert and then the glass house, the prison camp in the middle of it, so to speak. And so we get that sense of scale, of isolation, but it is vast and open and quite breathtaking. And then we have the tracking shot through the camp, and then you finally slowly it narrows down and narrows down until we get to the RSM and the introduction Staff Sergeant Williams, thank you. Yeah, and the establishment of that, and him saying goodbye to two outgoing inmates, and just giving us an indication of just like the power dynamics that are going on with these characters, and just claustrophobicizing the entire movie. So it's like this, it's at close quarters pretty much all the way through. It's the only slight respite that we get is on those scenes off campus where the commandant is with his lady friend and there's a bar scene, isn't there? That only give us a few seconds of anybody apparently looking like they're actually enjoying themselves. In fact, everyone, of course, in this movie is having a truly awful time, including the screws in this film. Everyone there is a prisoner. It starts off like almost feeling a little bit promising, like we could be something quite broad and quite wide and quite lovely, but actually, you know, in a few minutes we're getting down to it. And it's a lovely way to establish the film, and the credits rolling and the typeface of the credits, no music, just almost documentary like. It could have been a documentary. It couldn't have been, but you know what I mean. There was a documentary style to it, wasn't there, Graham?
Yeah. Oswald Morris is the cinematographer of this, and it's an absolute triumph from him. He's an established figure even at the time, but he's worked with some of the best names in filmmaking at that time. Cuts Chops working with David Lean, and then had a great relationship working with John Huston as well, and really, really experimented with early colour work there, which got him into trouble with the people at Technicolor, because he loved to wash out colours. And if you've ever seen Moby Dick, he was a cinematographer for that, and John Huston's other film, Moulin Rouge, as well in the 50s, which have a very, very different feeling to other colour films that were coming out at the time that really do shock you with loads and loads of colour. These were very, very muted, but very atmospheric. You say about how claustrophobic it feels. There's that whole feeling of British film at the time, this sort of like new wave sort of film, most of them very grim north films set in the north, usually involving a young woman getting knocked up. So it's like usually films like Room at the Top, The L-Shaped Room, Saturday Night, Sunday Morning, all of these films, This Sporting Life, Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner, all these really
Jackie
sort of,
Come Home, maybe.
Yeah, all these really grim films, but all these like really, really brilliant films. He worked on quite a few of these films, actually. But bringing it to the Libyan desert as well, bringing that feeling of desperation and of just being in a system that you can't control. it's very Victorian as well. This is what pretty much Dickens goes on about pretty much every book, and it's right there in the 60s, laid bare. And this is what he's talking about when he's saying, look, this is Victorian. This is just utterly Victorian, and we're still going through the same thing. He's very much talking like a 60s man, isn't he, at the time? But I think the filmmaking is so good, and Lumet just lets him get on with it. Morris had worked previously with Kubrick on Lolita, and apparently hated it because Kubrick was so micromanaging. He couldn't really do anything experimental. Lumet just said, fuck it, do it. Do what you want. The scene when Evans is Stevens. The scene where Stevens dies, you know, where he's marching up and down, and the camera starts spinning around. There, you can see the lighting rig on the ceiling, and they don't give a shit. They don't give a shit about it, because what they want is they want the shot. They want the craziness. We already know that the cell is lit by this one bulkhead lamp, and yet all of a sudden, and it's not just like sneaking in the corner that you can only see on widescreen TVs. It's there. It's right in the middle of the shot. These four spotlights are illuminating every corner of that room. But Lumet just goes with it. No one's gonna care because they're not looking at the lighting. They're looking at you, and they're looking at you dying. And it's things like that which said, well, you know, let the filmmakers just get on with it. Don't worry about it. Everything else is just hanging around it, and it just works brilliantly for me. But yeah, it's an absolute triumph from Oswald Morris, and a really interesting character as well. Won the DFC in the Second World War as a Lancaster pilot. So again, someone else who served, and then you can see this guy's going to know what these guys were like. And so, you know, he talk about being in claustrophobic environments. You know, you don't get much more claustrophobic than the interior of a bomber in the Second World War, no, I suppose.
Certainly but, not.
The stories that everyone brings to this are laid into this film, and they're baked in, and it's just a story that keeps on giving, I think, really, this film.
No, it really is. There is, and it's a film that, as I say, it stuck with me, and I think the thing that I was interested in going into this, and I'll put this one to Terry as well, is that at the time, Lumet is a very well-regarded maker. He was obviously starting to, you know, he'd come through in the 50s, made quite a lot of films. He'd made 12 Angry Men, which is, you know, what an absolute fantastic film, a really establishing film. And Terry, he then goes on, like, if you are a listener and you're not familiar with Sidney Lumet's filmography, you've got Serpico, Murder on the Orient Express, Dog Day Afternoon, which is quite possibly Al Pacino's best ever performance. And I think when you realize that, and if you know much about Sidney Lumet, or even if you hear those films in there, and they are actor-driven films, it suddenly becomes a lot more apparent that what we've got here is not a star appearing in a film for the sake of it. This is a proper director getting proper performances out of his actors, and I think crucially, Terry knows when to give each actor the screen time and the time to just let them appear on screen and let them do what they need, he wants them to do, as opposed to going, okay, well, we've got Connery, who's our star, let's give him as much time. If anything, Connery is probably a good reason that the film gets made. But both him and Lumet are perfectly content to bring out everybody else into there. This is, I'd say, Terry, it's not so much of a star vehicle as it is just an amazing ensemble piece.
Sure. It's definitely an ensemble piece rather than being Sean Connery's vehicle. I mean, he is the biggest star of the show, of the film, insofar as that he's the James Bond actor. And those James Bond films at this point are huge, they're massive films, but they haven't cut through in the way they do now. I mean, when this film is being made, there's only three Bond films that have come out. When it comes out, the fourth one has come out just before Thunderball is. I think this is made before Thunderball, but isn't released until after Thunderball. I may have that wrong, but I'm pretty certain that that's how it is. But irrespective, to answer your question, no, this is a strong ensemble cast with quality actors who are all given their time and their moment. I mean, we've not spent that much time talking about too many of the other actors in the ensemble. I think Ian Hendry, who apparently, again, this is what I read. I mean, maybe this may not have been the case, but I think Hendry was encouraged, nay, indeed ordered to method this and just act like the sergeant major on set, even when they weren't shooting, in order to get into that. Now, I don't know. Maybe that's not the case. I don't know. But, I mean, he is just loathsome, utterly, utterly loathsome. But at the time, and also at times, you know, his wretchedness comes through when he's off duty and he tries to punish. I don't know whether he's punishing himself or whether he's trying to prove himself by trying to take on the hill, and he manages a couple of rounds of it and then just like has to go back in and drinking himself into an absolute stupor and trying to play power play with the RSM, trying to take over the RSM's role and trying to outdrink him and failing, and just the utter wretchedness, but the brutality of the character, absolutely an extraordinary performance. Roy Kinnear, I mean, this is the same Roy Kinnear who I think for a lot of people, I think he's regarded more well known for being a comedy actor. And there's kind of comedy beats in this. Oh, I don't know whether or not that's that, or that could just simply be me projecting his comedy beats on there. Amazing. He methoded that role apparently, and then had to go into therapy afterwards at the end of it because it had wound him up so tight. And that's what I mean. But there's so much emotion coming through that I think that perhaps that's why some people might find it a little bit, you know, uncomfortable to watch. But also because, and this again is Lumet's decision making. If you were looking at it through a modern filter, this is going to sound crass. You're going to look through a modern filter. You might almost think you're watching some kind of scripted reality TV, rather than necessarily, you know, the actors acting, you know, to a script. Because for me, that's how close the surface it was. I mean. Totally not what was being attempted, because obviously it's 1965. But looking at it through a modern filter, that's what I thought, which is obviously crass because scripted reality TV is crass and shallow and lacking in substance. All the things that this movie is not. But nevertheless, these were the things that I was thinking of when I was rewatching it last week.
Oh, it's interesting, actually, because it brings to mind, I think ITV had a reality show that ran for a few seasons called Bad Lads Army, where essentially there were a load of ne'er-do-to-wells across Britain who were kind of brought in essentially into a sort of boot camp where the people who led it were not a million miles away in their approach from the RSM and Staff Sergeant Williams in how that they treated people, and yet that was done for entertainment, whereas here it is a real kind of indictment of just everything and everybody being completely broken in some way, shape or form. And again, like Graham, we kind of quite often talk of the films that are now kind of a bit older, when we discuss on Action Movie Landfill or Odd Job Pod, you know, does this hold up in modern audiences? Now, one thing that obviously stands out here and would have probably stood out at the time as well is the horrific racism and homophobia that comes from the military and the military establishment to Jacko, the character from Ozzie Davis, from a racism perspective, Stevens from a homophobia perspective. But it's I watched it and went, this is uncomfortable, but I also, it doesn't, it's one of those films that doesn't glorify it, but actually just feels like it is a, I'm trying to put the right word here, almost a necessity to be able to show just what they are trying to do with the characterization, and feels actually like a reflection and a and fair reflection of probably what most of us would have seen a lot of, or, you know, even now would perceive the army of that time potentially to be like, given the attitudes of that period in history.
Yeah, certainly. You would get introduced that right from the start, where there is they have the conversation about segregation, and as if to say, look, you're dehumanizing these people anyway. what place has segregation got now, isn't it? Really, it's the racism is stark, absolutely stark, and played amazingly by Ozzie Davis, who was a fantastic individual. I mean, activist, filmmaker, actor, did it all, really. There was some opposition to his casting. There was because he was playing a Caribbean character, and so British-based black actors would say, well, why wasn't that available to us? But obviously, it being a US production, really, they were the ones who bankrolled it. They got a US actor in there. And he plays it brilliantly. But yeah, I mean, it must have been a very, very difficult role. But I mean, if he was very much involved in the civil rights movement in America, so he must have looked at this script and thought, no, this is important. These are things that need to be said, because this is what the language is. This is what people are talking all the time. This is the way black people are treated and thought of. Shown by Roy Kinnear's character's attitudes to him, because Roy Kinnear is pretty much a lowlife. He's the lowest one. He's the proper criminal. He's the one who deserves to be in prison, because he is a criminal, and that's all he ever wants to be. But he's also one of the most easily likable. He's the one who will probably get away, and he does get away. He gets moved to another cell. He's the one who gets treated better than anyone. He just goes with the very much institutional racism. There's very little malice in anything he says. There's hardly any of it. It's a lot like the racism you get in the Ian Fleming novels, which is horrific, but almost malice free. And if you were to say if you could have a conversation with Fleming and you called him a racist, he would probably be shocked by that. He'd say, but I live in the Caribbean. How could I be racist? But it's that sort of completely out of step touch that this film gets right perfectly. And you see Harry Andrews' character, his racism is laid very, very bare right at the end, when he goes on about this, the whole talk about the end of the empire. So that also brings it down, brings it, as I said, very right back into the mid-60s. And then you get the sort of more underlying homophobia and almost the homoerotic stuff there as well, which you're always going to get in every prison drama, aren't you? Even in the 1960s. There is the conversation with Ian Bannon's character. We've not even mentioned him yet, Harris. No. And the conversation that he has with Stevens, and there is a kind of almost like you almost get the feeling, are you coming on to him or something? It's like that kind of feeling when he has to say, look, I'm not a puff. So, and there are that layers to it. I mean, I'm sure this is what the actors have brought on. They've looked at the script and they've read between the lines, and they've realized, this is how I'm going to play it. This is how I'm going to do it. And yeah, when I said about the racism in Fleming novels being without malice, the homophobia in Fleming novels, that is malice. That is malicious. Because Ian Fleming hates homosexuals. It's that comes across loud and clear in every time that the subject is brought up. And I think that is a very acceptable attitude to have in the mid-60s as well. So I think you don't see a lot of references to it in war films of the time, but it's there and it's here in this film. So yes, very difficult attitudes for modern audiences, but I think they're not thing. There's nothing here that you're gonna show someone, say who's under 30, who's gonna think, wow, this is, I can't believe that they made a film like this, because I think they could easily understand it because of the world we live in at the moment.
No, the film's not racist or homophobic at all, is it? It's absolutely the opposite. In fact,
yeah.
The film is very, very courageous in that respect, in portraying racism and homophobia in the way that it does. It's very brave, I think, to take on, the British establishment and challenge the British establishment in the way that it does, the British Empire, the British military system, however you want to call it, and expose it in this incredibly believable, very authentic way. And the authenticity comes through because, as Graham, you point out, these guys served, they would have had direct encounters with the British establishment, with the British military during the war, and they would have seen it with their own eyes and come away from that. And in a lot of cases, I think there were a lot of people who went to war, they didn't necessarily see action, but they would have seen plenty of guys like Sergeant Major Burt Wilson and Staff Sergeant Williams, and others. And that is their story of the war, and that's their understanding of the war. And consequently coming home with with probably quite a lot of complicated and complex feelings about their country and about its rulers. And I think the film genuinely, definitely speaks to that. And there's real courage in its anti-homophobic position, because homophobia in 1965 is mainstream. It is totally mainstream in 1965. It's very correct. There's a growing sense about racism, of anti-racism, for some time, and a tradition of anti-racism in art. Less so in dealing with homosexuality and homophobia. Homophobia is not even a word, is it, in 1965? Because at that point, it's so mainstream that nobody even thinks that there's, that you apply a word to something like this. I think Harris is a really interesting character. Ian Bannon, who, if you're a fan of the Smiley TV show, he's in. The first, I think he's in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, Ian Bannon. Great British character actor. Capable of being, going into maybe playing more effeminate roles, I don't know. And I think he walks that line because he could easily have just drifted into unnecessary camp, but doesn't. And actually walks the line as the character walks the line, because of course the character is desperately trying to stay on the right side of this sergeant major, while at the same time trying to do his best. He's the only person there who cares, and is still very much a wretched character in itself. It's a remarkable piece. The more you sit and talk about and think about it, the more you can get lost in this movie.
Easily. I mean, I think it's probably one of the films that I've seen which does not remotely try to pretend or skirt around those issues of racism and homophobia. It is nakedly on display, but it's nakedly shown because of it feels horrifically real. And the climax with Jacko, Ozzie Williams's character, where he strips down, and walks into the commandant's office, and you know, it's a speech that, you know, you can see that coming from the stage background onto it, but it is so incredibly powerful. And at that point, it just makes you stop, and the message that has come through into there, certainly in the 60s and the context of the 60s and Ozzie Davis, essentially, yeah, civil rights activist performing it, you go, wow, this is, you know, this isn't just a prison drama. It has a strong civil rights message going through. Even though it's, you know, it's a film about the British establishment, it's a film about everybody's racism and plays very much into what was going on in the US in the time. Just absolutely extraordinary. I mean, there's so many places that we could go. I feel like we could do almost like 3 hours on this this particular film. We absolutely won't, because I don't know, extended cut, director's cut. But Terry, one of the things that we haven't talked about, and I really, really want to talk about, is Harry Andrews, the RSM Wilson. Now, we all know that Connery is a very dominating screen presence, but Harry Andrews here, for me, if there is a star, if you want, or just a standout performance, and this Harry Andrews is RSM Wilson, has to pretty much, you know, he goes head to head with almost every single one of the actors at some point within this film, and it's genuinely one of the most, I think one of the most astonishing performances I've seen in any film from that era. It is just a phenomenal piece of work, and none more so when he's facing down an entire prison riot. That scene is just incredible. Every time that he is on screen, no matter whether he's up against Connery or Ian Bannon or addressing a near mutinous prison cell block, I honestly, yeah, I mean, that's my thought. It's not really a question. It's more of an observation that I'll throw to you, Terry. But it is just one of the best performances I think I've seen on screen for a very, very long time.
Yeah, and Harry Andrews is one of these actors who is, I think, certainly if you're British and of a certain age, you just know this guy because he's been in a ton of movies that you like, and he's been in a ton of movies that you don't really like that much, and that's because he's been in a ton of movies. I mean, his filmography before this is just as long as your arm. It goes all the way back to 1953. I mean, that guy did was work. And he has that's in addition to the stage work that he did as well. So one of the truly great character actors who clearly just played specific types of characters wasn't necessarily, I think, given too many vehicles all on for himself. But this, as we say, is an ensemble piece. But if this is anyone's vehicle, it's actually Harry Andrews. Because as you say, he interacts, I think, with almost, if not all, of the main characters and some of their other characters in this film. And he's pretty much the first person that we're introduced to in the film. He's not the last, but I think that it establishes him as the sort of main guy and certainly the glue of this movie. The character is horrific, and yet Andrews is able to convey a degree of charm, cruel charm about him, that actually convinces the audience, I think, for a short while at times, to even have some kind of residue of affection for him. Much like, I suppose, you do when you're trying to convince yourself that the bully is actually your friend, kind of way. It's an abusive relationship, but it's rare for I mean, you see that happening between the actors, that's one thing. When it's happening with the actor and the audience, it takes a special kind of performance and direction to be able to bring that through, and he achieves that And he achieves that. He leaves his mark on the audience. And yeah, as you say, I mean, of a number of magnificent moments that he has in this film, there are none greater, I think, than putting down the prison riot single-handedly. Pretty much single-handedly. Okay, the armed guards around him are helping him. But really, you almost get... He would have looked silly if he had just walked out there on his own. But actually, the way it was shot, and I think the way that it was portrayed, it was effectively one man confronting the mob, facing them down like the White Horse, and sending them on back into their cells, singing his name as they did so.
The guards aren't armed. He actually specifically says that. He says that. He says, should we get the guns? No. He says, no.
Absolutely right, yeah.
Absolutely,
yeah.
We don't need those. We can talk them down. And he does. This is the thing about... Obviously, he is the embodiment of the British establishment, isn't he? Well, actually, not the establishment. He is because he is the common man. And this is the worst thing about it. And what the thing about his character is he entirely believes in what he's doing. And he believes that he's doing it for the common good. The difference between him and Williams is in it for himself. And Williams is a psychopath as well. So that's the main difference. And that's why Wilson thinks he's better. He's better than everyone because he is the one with the vision, and he is almost like a cult leader almost in the way he hands out things there. And I think it's wonderful from the script because the script writer recognizes that. It'd be so easy just to make him as much of a shit as Williams is, but you don't have to. You have to just think, well, you know, this guy is everything in the embodiment of the ideal of the British Empire, that it is a force for good. And of course, you know, the rest of the world knows how wrong that is. But he is entirely, entirely convinced by the whole idea of it. In many ways, this is the sort of another story that you can look at it and think, well, this is the whole thing about why people become fascists. They think that they're doing the right thing, and yet it's not. This is the whole thing about fascism, really, isn't it?
He is a warning.
Yeah,
he is a genuine warning from the past.
Yeah,
because what he's saying, he is the kind of guy. The actual 1965 character, Wilson character, it goes on to vote for Margaret Thatcher in the 1970s. Mm. You know, I mean, this is the, you know, the officer class in this movie are mostly ineffectual, yeah. Useless, and have just abandoned it because, like the Empire, they have just, yeah, they're, I mean, well, they're officer class, but they've got the worst possible duty. You know, only the Russian front. If they'd been Germans, would have been a better gig. I mean, a truly awful gig out in the desert looking after the prisoners. They've abandoned it. But if you like your metaphors, you could say that this is a metaphor for the abandonment of the British Empire.
Oh, it's totally. But then you've totally got,
But then you've got this rump, this sort of like working class rump, who have embraced the Empire, and they bring the Empire forward at the moment when it's in its moment of collapse. They are the people who pick up the sort of post Suez depression of collapse of empire and surrendering empire to the United States, and they carry all of that sentiment and that belief about the ascendancy and the British and the greatness of the Britishness, you know, all the way through. And politicians have fed off that, and they feed off it to this day.
Yeah, it's that whole scene at the end. With King and the camp commandant, when he's just like, taking his fags and lounging on his sofa, and that is obviously the power play of newly independent African and Caribbean countries of just being say, well, we're on an equal footing now. I can call you by your first name, and that is just completely of its time. That really is sort of like, audiences there would have been very uncomfortable with that. And rightly so.
Mm. Well, I was going to say as well, that, you know, the you talk about Harry, Wilson and a lot of the other Wilson and Williams and warning of fascism that is coming or has come. And move on, and yes, they would be form working class, but form the solid rump of the Conservative Party. It's probably also worth pointing out that this movie is released 3 years before Enoch Powell's Rivers of Blood speech. And that is, when you look at the context in that, and when you bring it back to the performances and the script within there, you can see just how easy that line is and how. You suspect that RSM Wilson would have been one of those applauding Powell's speech and would completely have agreed with it. And, in 65, and you can see why the, the British government, the War Office were concerned about it as well, because, it meant to be the good guys. we're the ones that fought fascism. We're the ones who liberated Europe. And with a little help from America. But you take that and go, well, it's not an uncommon trope within films of, the heroes are no different from the enemy. But here it's just laid out starkly. Like the approach of Williams in particular, if you'd put Williams and RSM Wilson into a different picture as Germans, same approach into there, just different uniform and different accents. It's quite terrifying, actually, in some respects.
Yeah, but this is what makes it different. This different from a prisoner of war film. In prisoner of war film, oftentimes the guards there are at least slightly sympathetic, unless they're Gestapo. But you don't get that here, and that's because it is all about a British establishment, isn't it? That's what's really at the core of this film, rather than getting some chocolate off the friendly German guard, isn't it?
Yeah, no. The idea of a war film where the British are the enemy and the British are also the good guys, or really, I suppose, in reality, none of them are the good guys. Mm. It's just it's just an example of how war utterly dehumanizes people, but also. It dehumanizes decent people, but it also emboldens evil people, evil men, to do evil things. And the evil, vicious, brutal men exist in all countries, including Britain. You give them a uniform and you give them authority, you give them power to do that, they will express that. And especially if you put them in a hothouse in the middle of nowhere where nobody cares about you, then no one's watching you, So you're just give yourself absolute license to find your own entertainment and to fulfill yourself to give the worst version of yourself. It is ghastly and a shock. I mean, Harry Andrews is in another war film. He's in quite a few war films, but there's a couple that spring out on that list. There's one that was made just before this one, and that's 633 Squadron, and then there's one in 1958, and that's Ice Cold and Alex. That portrays very, very different types of soldier in those movies, much more in line with the kind of image that we want of ourselves when we come out of the Second World War, that we were the good guys, that we are nice people, we do nice things to people, that we fight with honor, and that we treat our soldiers with honor and ourselves with honor and dignity. Interestingly, I think about 633 Squadron. I've seen that film, and knowing that it's in 1964, and I think even then that movie is probably dated, even though I think it did very, very well, but it's probably dated. This is one of those movies, war movies, that is taking us into a period of the portrayal of the Second World War as less than favourable, as seeing the bad side of things. Not to the extent that The Hill does, but really, I mean, I don't think there's been a film. I don't know. That's maybe, I don't know. This could be untrue. It doesn't feel like there's been a film that is this down on the British that was made by the British. I know Lumet's an American and it was had American funding, but you know, a film that's this down on an allied country made in an allied country. I mean, it really is bleak. I'm sure there are other examples, but I mean, you're right. You could conceivably be portraying the fact that they're being portrayed worse than German prisoners of war guards, as you say, unless, you know, Graham, unless it's the Gestapo. You know, there's not that cartoonish villainy that comes with these kind of movies. This is just savagery. It's the savagery of the British state and the buy-in by the working class of Britain.
Exactly, yeah.
And it's Britain. It's Britain. Unfortunately, it's the absolute worst of our country, which makes it uncomfortable to watch.
Yeah.
If you live in this country and if you have some affection for this country, it's uncomfortable to watch.
I feel this is this is definitely a film that, you know, is obviously not massively well known, but watching it today, I feel that it should be much more well known and it should be rewatched in this day and age. It has so many messages which are disturbing and powerful, but resonate probably as loud as they do now in 2026 as it did in 1965, which is quite something when you go back and look at, you know, a lot of cinema from the time. This is definitely not a throwaway piece of cinema. It's not something where, you know, Connery was just doing to bide a little bit of time between films. So let's bring it back and bring it back round. So Graham, this is, you know, when you're kind of looking at, to come back to kind of Connery and Connery's career, this is released, I think you're probably right, Terry, it was, you know, it's around, he was made this before Thunderball, and they, you know, so you've got Thunderball, you've got Goldfinger, the other Bond ones. The other notable film that Connery had been in was Marnie, which we could have easily talked about, and I'm sure we probably will, obviously made with Hitchcock, but, you know, very different type of film to this one. And then really you've got a few more before, I would probably say, he comes back to work with Sidney Lumet in the Anderson tapes. And then you have got Murder on the Orient Express, which isn't too far after that as well. But for me, Graham, this film's like, it's a bit of a turning point for both Connery and Bond, even if it probably wasn't seen at the time. This is more looking back. From Connery's perspective, it feels after this, he's gone, well, I can do these big, now I can do these big serious films. I do not want to be typecast and characterized as just James Bond. Now, I doubt whether, you know, I doubt whether that is the main reason or kind of drove him into, I say drove him into, you know, because obviously some of his latter performances, you know, you do get a sense that he's playing Bond as Bond. But this feels like a point where he, you know, he's going, okay, right, here's me mapping out my career post Bond. I know that I can do this. I feel I can do this. And on the other hand, you've got Bond, which is, you know, Goldfinger is a brilliant film. And from Thunderball onwards, it starts to get, the Connery ones start to get a little bit in the kind of bombastic, over the top, slightly ridiculous way. Not that I'm saying there is anything wrong with hollowing out a volcano. I'm very glad that Ken Adam hollowed out a volcano. That is something that I think the world has been poorer for. However, as Connery has gone into probably, you know, The Hill is probably one of the most, you know, brutal pieces of realism from a cinema perspective you're going to get. And then you've got
Thunderball, and then you've got You Only Live Twice. Very different films. Graham, you do kind of wonder what was Connery's kind of mindset after watching that, other than kind of exhausted and quite knackered. Although he seems to you know, I think he went to make on a further three or four films with Sidney Lumet.
Yeah, he did.
And so he clear for whatever the conditions, I think he clearly enjoyed working with him as a director.
Yeah,
and,
certainly.
You know, and you can understand why. Like, you look, you know, if you're a director who can probably get a career-defining performance and probably the best performance of his career out of Al Pacino, then you are a good director. there is no nothing disputing that. So, yeah, Graham, you wonder what Connery was kind of feeling at this point of this midway. He doesn't know it's going to be midway through his tenure as Bond. He's three films in. He's clearly thinking about where do I go next. Bond franchises, you know, MGM and going, well, where do we go next with this? And there's definitely these two of A Hill and Thunderball coming together are points in time that diverge into very different places.
Well, yeah. I mean, he goes from having a stand-up row about the demise of the British Empire to strapping on a jetpack. That's basically what happens in the space of a couple of months, isn't it? And I suppose really because it's easy to look at Connery's career as Bond and think, well, you know, you were phoning it in a bit. But then he didn't know he was part of a 60-year franchise at the time, did he? All he knew is he was making a couple of films of a guy who was in some books, some very popular books. I suppose the closest thing he could have thought is that, well, am I now the new Basil Rathbone or something like that in the Sherlock Holmes film? Am I the new Johnny Weissmuller? Is that all I am now? And I suppose that's a very valid concern for an actor. There was no way of knowing whether or not the Bond films would just peter out after Goldfinger. So yeah, he did have to have a plan B, and I think this falls so well for him. The fact that he gets to work with such a good director. Sidney Lumet obviously brings out the best in him. And that's why he works with him over and over again in the future. Until everyone else can see what sort of actor he is and knows the sort of roles you can give him. And then that keeps him in gravy all the way through the 80s and the 90s. Yeah, I mean, this is a very, very, very important film. But then the rest of his work at Bond is important because that cements what is. If he'd stopped after Thunderball, I don't think would he have been well remembered? It's very difficult to say, really, isn't it? Because obviously, Diamonds Are Forever adds nothing to what he had done previously. And arguably Thunderball doesn't either. But there would have been someone else there. There would have been someone else coming in who perhaps wouldn't have struggled to take over as much as Lazenby and then Moore did at the time. So if someone else had come in and made Thunderball, which could easily have happened, considering the whole sort of huge shifts around it in the production of that film. And if he'd decided to go on and become, you know, get the roles that Michael Caine was getting instead. You've got to remember, this is made in the same year as the Ipcress file. So that also spins around the whole spy genre as well, and about how things are viewed differently. I think this is so important for Connery, and I think it's a great choice as our opener in this While They Were Bond strand that we've got, which we're still workshopping the name there, aren't we, Terry?
Oh, I thought While They Were Bond works quite nicely, to
yep,
be fair.
Yep, sure.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going for it. I think Bond fans should watch The Hill.
Definitely.
I think they should watch it. One primarily to see Sean Connery in a role they will, you know, that's so diametrically opposed to James Bond, but also because, you know, the film is a film of substance that has things to say about Britain in a way that James Bond also has things to say about Britain. And so I think it's, you know, if you're a James Bond fan, then you find that interesting, and you will find this interesting and challenging as well. And I certainly would invite James Bond fans to watch this movie, and be assured you will still love James Bond films when you watch this film. You will still love James Bond films. Don't worry. It's not going to break your brain. It might try, but it won't succeed. It's just a movie.
It may break your soul a little bit, yeah. But not your brain, not at all. And if anything, I think, you know, I came away, I already think Sean Connery is an excellent actor. I came away with going, wow, that was a performance in a film. And the type of film and the type of performance that I don't think really comes along too much. Obviously, he later won, you know, the Oscar for The Untouchables. But again, which was another, you know, ensemble film and another very, very enjoyable film. But if you were going to say, well, you know, anybody who was watching Bond and was like, oh, you know, Sean Connery, that's all he can do, you just have to show them the hill. Go, no, at the time, this is what he was doing. This is where he was going. And yeah, I think it's, for me, I'm first of all really glad that, Terry, you picked this one as the first one, because I think it is a really fascinating counterbalance to where Connery was at the time, and probably adds an awful lot when it comes to the understanding of, you know, you try and put it in context of to where that film was. Now, obviously, we've got the benefit of looking back, but from this particular film at the time, it feels like you've got a much more rounded idea of what Connery was trying to achieve with his career. Anyway, shall we discuss when they were Bond? I missed the workshopping of the name.
No, we are going to have to workshop this more, because we just can't say it out loud.
I mean, it's something, you know, it's the acronym. Wubububub. Yeah, again.
While needs they were... No. Wootwub. No. Wootwub. No.
Wootwub.
No.
Wootwub. Yeah. Mm. Wootwub. Yeah, I mean, that's somewhere in Australia. Yes. Hey, should we pick another film to do?
Let's do it.
I'm liking this brand.
Cool.
You go, Gary.
Go on, Gary. Why don't you pick one?
I have one. I'm actually going to go a lot later. So different Bond, different era. And a film that will almost certainly be not quite as much of a psychological drain as The Hill is. I'm going to go for The Tailor of Panama.
Ooh.
Pierce Brosnan.
Mm.
Latter end of his Bond career. And yes, actually not a film I've seen in a while, but given where Brosnan was with Bond, I think it will be a very interesting film to watch and pick around. Because let's face it, I could have just said, why don't we watch The World Is Not Enough again? But I'm pretty sure I would get a solid no from both my two co-hosts to that. But yes. Between The World Is Not Enough and Die Another Day, we have The Tailor of Panama, which I think might be a slightly more enjoyable watch than those two. But we shall see. It's been a while. My memories might be different into there. How are you feeling about that choice, gents?
I'm looking forward to it. Yeah, it's been a long time. I saw it not long after it came out. I think I didn't go and see it at the cinema. I watched it, I think, when it came out on Sky, I think, and I haven't seen it since, I don't think. So, yeah, it's got to be a good 25 years since I've seen it, I think.
Yeah, same here. That's a film with stuff. That's Graham Greene, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, yeah. That's got some things to say, that movie. So it's a nice, it's good that we're doing that, we're going on there. Yeah, it's not as harrowing as The Hill. But it does have some moments in it, if I remember rightly. But again, I think, like you, Graham, I didn't see the pictures. I saw it on the telly not long after it came out on the telly. So at least 25 years, which is depressing in of itself. But yeah, yes. So I'm very excited to be able to see that. And I think that that is an excellent choice. Yeah, a nice spy film to go with our kind of spy adjacent podcast.
Yes.
Yeah. We definitely, you know, we've done action, we've done harrowing war dramas, but let's get back into what we love about Bond, which is spying and, you know, exploding watches and keys that wolf whistle keys that will blow up onto a bad guy. You know, that's what we came here for, but like lots of other things as well.
But next, it's the biting satirical critique on Chinese communism that we're doing next. Is that right, Graham? I can't remember what we're doing.
We're doing Rush Hour next. Action movie.
Biting satirical critique on Chinese communism.
Yes,
That's what it says in Wikipedia, anyway.
Well, yes.
I saw a YouTube video where someone said that that's what it was. So it must be.
I mean, look, would you get any other podcast that would sandwich The Hill and then a Graham Greene drama with a biting critique of Chinese communism that is Rush Hour? I don't think so. You cannot get this podcast. It's just completely different from anywhere else. And if that doesn't sell it to you, I don't know what is. What will. Oh, well. Thank you for coming on this journey up and down the hill with us. Honestly, if you haven't seen this movie, please just go seek it out. It is well worth your time. Don't expect to just sit there and watch it with popcorn and be entertained, because it's not that type of film, but it will stay with you for a very, very long time. And
You might be entertained, depending what sort of sadistic person you are. I mean, if you like, you're like Williams, you'll love it. You just get a whole, you'll enjoy it on a different level. But
filming being shown at Reform's annual convention. Yeah.
If you're a British person, there's a high statistical probability you'll find it highly entertaining.
Yes, I forget. Not everybody thinks like us. Anyway, and maybe the world is a much worse place for that. Maybe, maybe not.
Maybe.
Well, just remains for me to say thank you very much, Graham.
Thank you, Gary.
And thank you, Terry.
No, thank you, Gary.
And thank you, dear listener, for your ears during this period. The Odd Job Pod will be back, as will Action Movie Landfill, and would a bit still needs workshopping into that. Until then, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Cheese for dinner tonight.
Hooray!